Rob McMahon, I'm going to say quickly, is in Alberta at the University of Alberta in Media and Technology Studies at the Department of Political Science at the University of Alberta. His work focuses on the appropriation of broadband and internet technology by First Nations and Inuit communities. Rob has done award-winning research highlighting many innovations taking place in the peripheries of the emerging network society, which I think is really kind of it's very interesting to me because I'm very much a student of Marshall McLuhan's work, and he always said, look for the stuff that's coming in on the corners and on the edges of the network. So Rob has been instrumental in the First Mile Connectivity Consortium, and I think I'll let him speak for himself. Welcome, Rob.
Yeah, thanks, Marita. Thanks, everyone. Hi. Great to be here. Thanks for the opportunity to meet everybody online and talk a little bit about the work being done by the First Mile Group today. So, as Marita mentioned, I'm in the Department of Political Science, but I just wanted to briefly mention before that, when I joined academia, I guess, like I've been working with Brian and Susan O'Donnell and others who are now part of the First Mile, so we all work together to found that organization. We continue to work together on it. So I kind of come from communications, and then I went into the Faculty of Extension when I got a professor job, assistant prof job, a few years ago now, and that was a really interesting faculty, I guess, in the sense that it was all about community engagement. And so myself working in communications, but we had other people in other areas. And I just wanted to note this because I know Fred had mentioned he's in Newfoundland and studying there, and I know Memorial had a strong tradition of this kind of work around community engagement and extension and stuff. So that's kind of where I sit, is sort of like, it's not really political science. I always tell people I'm in political science, but I'm not really a political scientist. I'm rather interested in the community aspects of technology development, and especially how groups, in northern parts of Canada and rural areas, Indigenous groups are setting up, taking control and ownership of their own internet infrastructure, and then all the wonderful things that happen when we see that. So, I guess I'll share my screen, and then I have a little bit of a presentation, and I could kind of go through that in 15 minutes, 20 minutes or so, because I'd love to just open it up for discussion too, and hear from you all. So, can everybody see that? Can you see my screen okay and stuff?
Yeah, looks good
Yep.
to me.
Okay, fantastic. Okay, so these are kind of the principles around the work with the First Mile with respect to community-based digital ICT information and communication technologies research. So really like that strong focus on identifying and utilizing community expertise, so involving people in communities in the research activities, in co-authorship and presenting together. So really that relationship and relational community building part of the research is really central to the work. And then how do we mobilize research in order to support benefits for the community team members? So these would be things like highlighting success stories, doing public outreach, and doing things like policy and regulatory intervention. So I'll talk a little bit about the First Mile or FMCC, the First Mile Connectivity Consortium's work in that area as well. And then as well, just creating and sharing different resources, toolkits, curriculum around digital literacy that really fits the interests, desires of people in the communities. It's just like anything else, it's not a one-size-fits-all model. So the ways to experience teaching and learning in digital literacy also ties into the specific interests of communities and where they're situated. And that idea that, these deficit models, we hear the digital divide, like Brian has talked a lot over the years about, it's like the communities at the end of the road that get service extended to them. But those really fail to acknowledge community assets and strengths. And so the kind of approach we take with the group is that there are these structural challenges, there are these histories of colonialism and limited infrastructure and inadequate service, et cetera. But there are innovations happening throughout communities that are really driving their own solutions to these challenges. And so the role of us as researchers and as policy advocates and as partners is to figure out like how can we bring forward those strengths, and they already have the knowledge and expertise to solve these issues. And how do we actually go about like working with them to move that forward, that type of strategy. So the different enabling conditions for this work, you know, there's access and availability to connectivity, there's affordability, the costs, and then the adoption of technologies. I won't spend much time on this because I know you're all very invested in this work over years, but that kind of idea of digital inclusion features very prominently in the work. And then within the first mile itself, we got together as a group. I'll talk a bit more about the group itself, but you know, the common sort of framework or principles uniting everybody in their diverse contexts is that locally driven technology projects can support all kinds of things: network sustainability, capacity building, community development. And this is sort of the theory of change, where you have regional and local digital networks that are designed and built with the community or the regional needs as a starting point. And then that being supported by regional and local ownership and control of the infrastructure itself. And then that in turn helps build I won't call it a business case. It's more like an organizational operating case. As you're all aware, like there's fantastic work, and many of you are doing this work in the nonprofit sector. So that's why I don't use business case. I say like operational case, for things like different anchor tenants that might support connectivity and sustain these networks. And then a real focus on regional and community level training, local support staff, community jobs, and then all of these things coming together to support sustainable technologies to meet needs and desires of people in the communities. This work draws a lot on, of course, like areas you're familiar with. Many of you were involved in this. I know Marita and others, like with the things like the community access program or the e-community perspective of the Assembly of First Nations, which kind of takes a look at all the different ways that digital technologies are supporting different aspects of our society. And it's just become even more prominent now with COVID-19, right? I don't think anybody has to argue about the importance of access to, you know, affordable, accessible infrastructure anymore, just given what we've seen over the last year in particular, even though, of course, it's always been that case in many of these communities that wouldn't otherwise have sort of brick and mortar services available. So just looking at this whole e-community model of different ways that the connectivity can support public services and economic development and community development. I'm also showing this. Brian and Susan developed this, this whole community approach, which takes a look at, you know, within policy, within development of infrastructure and services, it's not just at that household individual level. So oftentimes you see this reflected in some policy and sometimes in the ways that we track connectivity across Canada, that sometimes it gets focused on individual or household level statistics or measurements. But of course, it involves much more than that. You know, community level services or businesses or organizations aggregating up to the regional level with examples like KNET, and then even up to the environmental impacts, you know, surrounding land and waters and so on. So a very holistic approach to where connectivity fits in these different areas. This is just an example of a local network. This is up in Iguyavik in Nunavik, Quebec, where you have, so this is the topmost community in Northern Quebec. I did some of my PhD research here, and they were connected by a satellite system that was a cooperative system that was run by KNET and the KRG, Katowic Regional Government, as well as Broadband Communications North in Manitoba. And it was just such an amazing example because you had these regional indigenous groups collaborating to set up a cooperative satellite infrastructure. And then also even at the local level, people were accessing wireless internet systems. So you can see here, like there's the community on the right side at the bottom here. And within that community, Tomasi Manuik here, he's like a web developer. He's an artist. He does training of how to set up websites, like these kind of things. So that was one of those aha moments where I met him, I heard his story, and it just blew my mind back then. And so really got me like interested in the potential of some of these things. These are some photos from the Northwest Territories as well. This is just one example of many of people setting up their own fiber optic infrastructures. So you can see here, they're trenching, like digging a trench in the cold, you know, and then they lay out the conduit and the fiber. And again, this really impressed me at that time, you know, looking at working in these temperatures, you know, minus 30, minus 40, you know, kind of thing. But the community is out there pulled together and built their own internet infrastructure. So I found that really, really inspiring. So I'm showing these two examples, but of course these are happening all across Canada. And so I became interested in this work and then reached out to different groups. Brian was heavily involved in this when I was doing my PhD, helping connect me and mentor me, as well as Susan and others, to learn about this work and just seeing like the range of it happening with these Indigenous community networks across Canada. So I'd like to show those specific examples and then, wow, look at all this amazing work being done. And then another piece of this is the sort of the regional level, which are the First Nations SchoolNet, which I'm sure some of you probably were even involved in the discussions around setting it up and stuff. But these regional management organizations, such as KNET and First Nations Education Council and others, you know, this is to illustrate that these community networks weren't happening in isolation. They were also supported by these regional groups that were set up by the First Nations and Inuit communities. And then these in turn, you can see here in this photo, are also like connecting together across Canada. So we often talk about the internet as a network of networks. So here we have local networks connecting to regional and then connecting up to the national level in Canada. So I always give the example of KNET. Brian was working there. Now Penny Carpenter is the executive director, as one of these regional organizations in Northwest Ontario, established by the communities for the communities, and have a history of partnerships with different organizations, as well as with the communities that have really driven that work. So what do these types of regional organizations, what kind of activities are they involved in? So they act as a mediator between the work happening in communities on the ground and then external or larger or, you know, far off organizations such as government, funders, corporations, that kind of thing. They're represented and governed by groups of local communities. And then that allows for benefits of cooperation. So access to services, economies of scale when you're purchasing bandwidth or equipment, this kind of thing. They also will use digital technologies to deliver core public services. So things like education to schools or bandwidth for healthcare. Again, with COVID, this has really hit the news, so to speak, really blown up. But of course, these groups were doing it since the early days of the internet, that making that link between digital ICTs and core public services. And then they advocate and administer infrastructure and services on behalf of their communities. And part of that is through policy and regulatory engagement. And that was really one of the drivers of the foundation of the First Mile Connectivity Consortium. So that consisted of a group of researchers, of people working in those regional organizations, coming together and deciding that, you know, is there a way we can mobilize the research and all the work being done in order to support arguments to, you know, put forward proposals for policy, for regulation at CRTC, to make sure that regulatory structures, policy, funding, programs, that kind of thing, really meet the needs of these organizations that are already doing this work. So trying to point out what are the limitations of existing policy, what are the limitations of existing regulations, and then how could specific reforms help, address the needs and requirements of these groups. So here are the different first mile organizations here. So in different parts of Canada, we have the way that this is sort of structured is almost like a federated nonprofit. So each of these groups is working independently and then come together to co-develop and sign on to these policy proposals. And then we put those forward as a group together. So it's kind of like everyone's doing their own thing. And then we pull together like the expertise from this various areas in the context of a specific like regulatory proceeding or a policy consultation. So we have a process where, we put forward draft proposals, review those as a group, get evidence from the various parties for their experiences on the ground doing this work, and then kind of develop a second draft where we pull it together in response to whatever the issue is being considered in the policy consultation, and then put that forward. And over the years, we've been doing this in different fora, which I'll talk about in a moment. But that's kind of like the goal. There's no kind of paid staff or anything. Like all of the group is generally like, volunteering their time for this. And then for the people involved in, there's some consultants involved, including myself, like preparing policy submissions. And then we follow a process at the CRTC where you can get a cost claim. It's almost like in a court case when you file for not damages, but you file for support for the work that's done. And then that is reviewed by the CRTC and then approved or not based on the contributions that are made in the policy. I hope I'm not going into too much detail, but I did want to mention like around the funding aspects of that, and I could expand on that further if people have any questions after. So this is a photo. We're really proud of this one, like the work with the CRTC basic service objective. We were one of several groups, public interest, consumer groups, other Indigenous groups that appeared before the commission in 2015, 2016 and argued for that updated basic service objective and the establishment of a broadband fund. And that I think that was a big win, for a lot of nonprofit groups because it opened up funding that was previously unavailable for infrastructure in a nonprofit basis, as well as set some updated standards for what every Canadian should have access to with respect to speeds and other metrics, speeds and data caps and things like that. And over the years, we've been quite involved at the CRTC. So I just show this list to demonstrate the different types of things that get covered in these regulatory hearings. So you have everything from satellite services, they conduct reviews over that, pricing for such. The basic service objective, so what's the standard of connectivity in Canada, aspects of funding, right? So the development of the broadband fund and even the application guide, like they actually released that and then invited people to comment on that. So you could take a look and say, well, what should the applicants know when they're applying and what should applicants be obligated to do if they receive funds, right? So a big push there was make sure that funding projects funded through the CRTC fund were open access projects, so others could benefit from that infrastructure that gets funded in this way. And then right now there's a few going on currently, just barriers to transport. If you're a nonprofit provider, how do you actually access backhaul transport infrastructure? And then as well, how do you access, hydro poles? Can you hang your fiber to the home project on these hydro poles? What are some of the barriers to that? So it's pretty geeky stuff, but it's all part of that. What are the specific barriers and limitations and ways that we can improve access to different aspects of connectivity development for Indigenous and nonprofit providers? And as well as the CRTC, there's other policy consultations. Spectrum's a big one, access to different aspects of spectrum. Sometimes there's parliamentary committees on this stuff. So there's one on rural broadband and another one on affordability and accessibility of telecom. And then things like ISED's Universal Broadband Fund. So there's always these consultations going on. It's hard to keep track sometimes, frankly, but there's lots of opportunities for groups to participate and put forward arguments for them. I just wanted to mention too, there's also involvement of the group in media. So we did some stories around, like, especially around COVID-19 and the stress that increased bandwidth use was having on some of the nonprofit Indigenous providers. And then as well, just collaborating with different groups. So ISOC, the Internet Society, does an annual Indigenous Connectivity Summit. So First Mile's a partner in that and involved in presenting and sharing information there. And then also at the provincial or regional level, there's organizations, like a few years ago we did in Alberta, some work with the Digital Futures Group, which is about rural broadband in Alberta. I'm not sure, but I think James Van Leeuwen was part of Telecommunities Canada. So
still is.
Oh, wonderful. Okay. Yeah. So James was kind of involved in some of those too. We did one in Pincher Creek. Yeah, so this is kind of the last slide. So just I invite everybody to check out our website. It's at firstmile.ca. We have some community success stories and different news stories about the work of the partner organizations. We try to share digital literacy resources when we can. And then we have a course on, it's called Colonialism in the E-Community. And we're just in the process of updating it now. It was getting a little out of date, but it focuses on some of the issues I talked about today in a little bit more detail. Yeah, so I'll stop there so we have time to chat and hear any questions you may have. Yeah, and then this is just sort of the final slide, just stressing that community engagement piece. So thank you so much for the chance to present today.
Thank you, Rob. It's fascinating, the work you're doing. And some of it takes me back to the work we did years ago, going to the CRTC and presenting. We haven't done that for a while. But as you say, you know, it's hugely time consuming just to keep up with the kind of things that go on there all the time. So you gotta, you know, we don't have anyone right now who's focusing on that particular aspect. But so happy you guys are doing it. And I think that if there's a place where we can cooperate and lend our voice to what you're presenting, CRTC or elsewhere, that would be, you know, I think that would be really useful kind of partnership, because, you know, we're all small groups and we only, our resources only go so far. But if we can put things together a little better, I think, that we'd be very happy to do that. Somebody else, please just buy in.
Brian.
We can hands, but go ahead.
Brian has put a question in the chat.
Brian has put a question in the chat. How do you deal with the systemic racism embedded in the telecom industry and government's corporate captured approach to programs and their urban-based biases as they evaluate and determine who gets the money? That's a question for Rob, I guess. Is it, Brian?
Yeah.
It's a hard one, Brian. I think what you're saying about systematic or structural racism is part of the role of research. You know, I think when we look at the policies and the way that infrastructure gets rolled out and just the barriers that get faced, that's how I see kind of structural or institutional racism. It's like how these things have developed over time and had blind spots or barriers for different groups, right? And so when you say, how do you deal with this? I think a big role of researchers, and especially in projects like this, that you know, you have a research team, some of whom happen to be based in universities, and then others are based in communities or in organizations, and identifying where those barriers are, and then bringing those to light, right? So this is where I think some of these policy consultations, this is something another person involved in, Heather Hudson, really helped like teach me about, is like sort of you know, you have these submissions that are on the public record, and you can point out, and it becomes part of the evidence on the public record. So if you say, well, this doesn't make any sense, this group's getting charged more than that one, why can't this group access this at the same level that that group can? And then it just becomes part of that record of, the public record of how these things get developed and implemented. So I suppose, I don't know if that answers all of your question, Brian, but I think there is a role for research there, and there is a role for policy engagement there. Just in pointing those things out and pointing out some potential solutions for them. But of course, it's ongoing process. And I think even being there, and we have heard, I'll say this too, and I apologize everyone if this is too long an answer, but it's a hard question. But, you know, we have heard this from CRTC commissioners, you know, like, being there is important in and of itself, because it's like they have very well resourced groups. They're there all the time. And it's like Marita was saying, like a lot of groups and organizations don't have the resources. They certainly have the expertise, right? And the knowledge, and they could be there, but it's like expensive and time consuming. And so it's like they kind of get more of a bias of certain kind of groups there. And they can only rule on and make decisions on things that are on the public record. And I think just being there and putting forward this evidence and showing a different perspective, they invite that. They've encouraged us. They encourage others, because it does provide sort of a counter perspective there. So I think that's one of the values of doing this type of work in terms of policy engagement.
Can I just follow up a little bit? I guess my, like, about that whole thing, like even the institutions, the research institutions, like, you know, how difficult it has been over the years to be able to identify the expertise, but also the willingness to do what you're doing. And, like, you know, your own personal growth, including myself too, I can speak for myself in terms of understanding that racism, the racist education system, the racist colonial system that we've been indoctrinated into, and are very privileged as white people to be able to participate in. But, you know, those challenges, you know, that whole ability to be able to recognize the different communities, the different regions, the different solutions, and the different opportunities that you highlight in terms of the assets that every community brings. And I think that leads me to that point about your work in Northwest Territories now, that I think is this group, like the telecommunities group, needs to know about, because, like, I find it just amazing to have been able to go up to Nuvik and be able to recognize the differences that exist across the country.
Yeah, Brian, there's nothing like actually going somewhere and seeing and personally experiencing the differences, you know, to you can read about these things, but when you actually see them, then they really hit home, right? I think that ISOC Indigenous Summer Summit was actually held in Northwest Territories year ago or last year. I've never been there, but appreciate your thoughts there. It's always, you know, Rob is, you know, Rob and the whole First Mile group is deeply involved in this, but some of us around can hopefully, you know, help with sharing resources, and that way, you know, help move things ahead. I see Garth's got his hand up. It helps if we put our hands up when we can talk, other than, yeah, go ahead, Garth.
Rob, in the history of Telecommunities Canada, which goes back to the formation of the Victoria Freenet and the National Capital Freenet in 1991, classically what we've always found we had to oppose was the fact that Canadian telecommunications policy is, quote, market-based, end quote. And so I'd appreciate your thoughts on how Indigenous groups and First Nations have been able to maintain a locally based community focus in the face of that inexorable expansion of a market-based approach?
Yeah, that's a great question. Yeah, and so part of this is, so you have this, as you say, right, like that foundation in policy and regulation that market forces to the maximum extent possible. And I think the argument there in those cases is that there's actually cases of market failure because the market has not driven connectivity to these areas. And what we have is almost like this cycle where you have, these limitations of bandwidth, and then there's a government program that puts forward public funding for that. Then that goes out, and then the cycle just happens again. Like, how many times have we heard about these funding programs that are supposed to connect the north or connect the communities and stuff? And I think part of that is because that type of solution just doesn't work in that context. So what gets put forward instead is that, you know, the communities are operating, and Brian could speak to this, I think, in the KNET context as well, but I would say that the communities are using cooperative and nonprofit models, which benefit people in those spaces and also drive connectivity. So instead of, you know, seeing these communities as a profit center where you're going to get revenues and then redistribute those to shareholders, you know, who are wherever, it's about delivering services on a nonprofit basis. So the revenues come in and sustain the network instead. And there's no obligation to generate growth or generate profit in the same way. And then instead it becomes a conversation about, well, why are people using these networks? Well, it's about delivering core public services, such as health and education, and delivering economic development opportunities. And I think one of the things we can really learn from Indigenous communities, when I say we, I mean as a society, you know, they have this strong conception of citizenship to their nations, and then they have jurisdiction over the delivery of health services and education services. And so the technology becomes a way to deliver those things, the public good, the public services. So it's like different, right? It's different than that compared to seeing the citizens as a way, or consumers, you know, who purchase services and then it's to generate stuff. So yeah, I think it's a combination of like the failure of the market to deliver it, and then the self-determination of the communities to take that control over their these public services and deliver them in that way instead.
Anyone else got their hand up here? Fred, Ivan, you don't have video on, so if you want to butt in, just butt in. Okay, I have a question. Rob, how successful have groups been in getting money from that CRTC broadband fund? I haven't been following it. But, you know, I it's relatively new. I mean, relatively. How hard is it? Are people really benefiting from that?
Yeah. You know what? I wish I had better news. Some groups are, and some First Nations organizations have, and nonprofits. At the same time, other groups like, well, I shouldn't put it like that. I sound like I hate all commercial providers. I don't, okay? They all have a role to play in the ecosystem. But I'll say, like, in the Northwest Territories, Northwestel got a big chunk of funding to roll out fiber optic infrastructure in the communities. When that will happen will be a few years from now. So that was a big announcement as one of the big first, groups that received funding. But at the same time, other Indigenous groups have as well. Like, I know in Alberta they have, and in other cases in Canada. So yeah, groups are starting to receive it. It's quite an onerous process to apply for it, though, honestly. But there are lots of cases of groups starting to receive the funds.
Peter, was that you putting your hand up? No. Okay. Um, somebody else there?
I will.
Okay.
I was just meeting with the project lead for the Nunavik group and in Northern Quebec, and they're rolling out fiber. They're hoping to do it this this spring and summer undersea fiber to connect their coastal communities up the Hudson Bay. And it's a multi-facet type of project to do a complete loop from Jessesebe in Quebec up to Salawit eventually, and then over to working with mines, working with the provincial government, all of these relationships. And I thought Rob would like to know about that one, but it's really exciting. Dan Pellerin, who I used to work with at KNET, is leading that. And for this group here, and they've got funding applications into the CRTC, they've got funding applications into all of these different programs. And the amount of work it takes to do that, like Dan knows all about that. We did it, and we had to do that as well. So anyway, I just wanted to share that story as one example. And like, they're waiting for the CRTC after their first round, but they've done all the work that's necessary to do that. And it's a matter of finding the right people. And I guess that's what it all comes down to, is it's a people-driven type of initiative and the right kind of people. And I've got to say, like, Rob is one of those people that has been that we were able to identify in his early days of academia, like whenever he was doing his doctoral research. And he's now flying with it, with this work. And like, you know, and I really appreciate what he's done. And so I guess I just wanted to share that there's still lots of good work that is being done, like with the partners and their efforts to participate. And that's why the systemic racism question comes up, is often people just don't understand that that it does take those community champions, like, you know, and like, you know, that understand how the telcos have behaved in these rural communities. And there's very few people that really understand it like Rob does. And like, you know, until you go live in these communities and are doing the work in those communities, it's really hard to transfer that kind of expertise and that kind of experience to others in Ottawa, for example, who are making these decisions, especially the engineers who depend on the telcos, and the telcos depend on the engineers to push their corporate agenda. And it fits really nicely to keep the cycle of dependency going round and round. Anyway, like, you know, I could go on and on, but like, Rob, this is your show. So like, I really, like, you know, I still think that the Northwest Territories stories that you're creating in terms of the toolkits are really important category, like, you know, support systems for those communities to recognize their assets. And I'm wondering if you want to talk about that a little bit, about those tools that you've introduced.
Yeah, sure. So what I have a project in the Northwest Territories, it's through ISED, actually. They had a digital literacy exchange program. And it had to do with developing teaching and learning resources around digital literacies. So we put in a proposal in the Northwest Territories that was about co-designing digital literacy curriculum with the idea, like, we're partnering with Aurora College, and they have a network of adult educators that offer like things like upgrades to schooling and things like this, right? So they have community learning centers. And the concept was to develop some three courses on different aspects of digital literacy in partnership with communities, and then have them sort of transferred over to these adult educators as well as community champions who would go out and teach them. But the real kind of thinking behind that was to look critically at the internet. So yeah, we did do one kind of basic level course on, you know, here's how you, you know, here's how you avoid online scams, like this kind of thing, or, you know, use social media, this kind of thing, all important stuff. But then we also introduce some aspects of advocacy, right? So how do you test your internet speed? How do you file a complaint with the CRTC? And then as you start to learn that, showing people, okay, well, what's a community network? So we actually built, we call it a guided learning exercise. So imagine like a tabletop model where we print out a map of the people's community and then have 3D printer pieces. They're the different pieces of infrastructure, and then anchor tenants, you know, a school, a hospital, houses. And then you go through a series of steps like, okay, let's connect your community. Show us where your house is. And then you put your house on the map. Where's your school? And then you wire it up, right, with yarn. So we wire it up, and then we end up building a network to show them, well, this isn't just magic that comes from the air, right? Like, this is the infrastructure of building a community network. So that's the conceptual piece. And then our final course, and I was really excited to hear people are looking at mesh networks. So we were thinking of building a small scale kind of demo version of a mesh intranet. So it's like, okay, well, here's how you conceptualize it and visualize it. Now let's just actually pull these elements out of a box, and then you can build a small scale version. And the hope is that that'll just show people the possibilities. Like, there's more than just purchasing services from a different group. Here's how you can do it. So this is one thing I'd love to connect more with your group on too. Like, there's the policy side, but there's also like, how do we communicate and think about this stuff in terms of infrastructural digital literacy, people building and seeing the possibilities of different forms of community network.
Ellie, your hand's up.
I was just wanted to sort of echo that. So my background is in community radio. And so I worked at a station in Halifax, and then I worked here in Ottawa for the National Association. So I ended up getting, you know, hearing a lot of different stations. And part of what's so powerful about it that you're also describing is, first, that it's very community led, obviously, and it builds on community assets, which is what you started off talking about. But then also, it is this very hands-on approach to people sort of like owning infrastructure and thinking about infrastructure in a tangible way. And so that is for sure a big piece that we want to sort of take from community radio in the context of a mesh network if we go forward, which is, you know, how do we, yes, deliver internet that's kind of more affordable, but also teach people how to think about the internet and what that connectivity means in a hands-on way. Yeah.
No, that's so cool. Can I just say one thing is, I love the fact that you're doing it in somewhere like Ottawa too, because it shows as well that you can do it in places that everybody thinks, oh, well, it's all connected, but there's other opportunities too. And I've heard about these mesh networks in urban places, and I love that, you know, because it just shows that it's not like we reach a certain point and then nothing new can happen. It's already connected. It's like, no, you can build on top, you can have these alternative networks. So I'd love to connect to talk more about that. That sounds super cool.
Yeah, for sure. And also, when we talk about sort of everyone being connected in an urban context, obviously it means there is the access, which is a huge issue in remote communities and rural communities, but they don't have true access because they can't afford it, obviously, right? So that's the other big piece. Yeah.
Anyone else in this group involved in mesh networks or have been involved in mesh building? Fred? No.
Do we know where the Halifax network experience of this eventually went? Is it still in existence?
Shebucto Community Net is still in existence. So they wired two buildings. So they have like a point-to-point system from the university, and as far as I know, it's still delivering internet. So they were offering 15 meg synchronous, but it was wired within the building, so they weren't sort of distributing it other than that. But it is one of the things that we're kind of building off of. Yeah.
Okay.
We got close a couple of times in Jamestown in downtown Toronto, Wellesley and Parliament area, beaming signals to rooming house roofs, and then literally dropping wires down in through people's windows. so that people who just come out of homelessness would have had access. We got to about three houses that got put together. And we even tested the coffee can for beaming the signal, and it works. It was a bit short-lived. The leadership around that was, wonderful, dedicated, and sporadic as they dealt with their own issues that they needed to deal with.
Peter, was this during the cap period?
Yeah.
Okay, I know about that. Yeah, yeah. It's not going anymore though, eh?
Well, actually the chap who was leading it got healthy and moved to Victoria and is running a live edge meat cutting board business.
And his name was?
Daryl Hobbs.
Yes, that's right. Yeah, yeah. I was meeting with him.
So his success became our failure, but that's okay. The project was a huge part of his success. Is that Daryl?
Hi, Peter.
Oh, shit. How you doing?
I'm doing well. How
about you? Just come up as iPhone and I didn't see you.
Yeah, sorry.
Okay. Well, you should put a plug in for your boards.
Go to my Facebook page. You'll see them. I got some new ones.
Excellent.
Well, hi, Daryl. We haven't spoken for a long time, and I didn't know because you're just as iPhone on here, so I didn't know who you were.
Yeah.
Welcome.
Yeah, thank you. Just a couple of comments about the whole thing that everybody's going through right now with all this internet. One of the things I think is going to probably replace a lot of the fiber optic and coaxial cable is the 5G networks that are coming out. So basically what that means is they can put this stuff on the existing cell phone towers and broadcast signals at a higher frequency and a higher wattage. So right now, I think they're broadcasting about 20 watts for cell phone and about 0.5 for the Wi-Fi. So I think happens here is that in order to expand on this community-based internet program across Canada, including Indigenous or anybody else who needs it, wants it at an affordable price, you have to lobby. Someone has to actually go to Ottawa, talk to these people and say, look, this is not a partisan project. It's a encompassing community project across Canada. So how do you do that? Well, the only way I know how to lobby people is to get paid for it. So it comes down to money. I mean, let's face it, the TELUS, Rogers, Bell, they make money. That's what they do. They're corporations. They can't really see past that. So you really need a strong lobby person to go to Ottawa and talk about how this benefits Bell, TELUS, Shaw, Rogers. How do they make money out of it? And so, like I said, to me, this is the biggest challenge that we have is the money part of it. It's all great to have all these resources and technical skills, and that's all wonderful. But where does the rubber meet the road? How do you roll out these projects, these equipment to the point where everybody has access? And again, like I say, what I see happening in the main carriers is that they're going to start putting out this 5G network on their cell phone towers. And then of course that's gonna expand to more cell phone towers and more cell phone towers. So what I thought would be a good way to approach some of these larger carriers is to make their cell phone towers hotspots for either Wi-Fi or again, an affordable cell network. Right now I'm with Bell Mobility. I used to pay $50 a month for no data. And I called him up and I said, I'm a loyal customer. They reduced it to $25 a month. Now, I don't do any data other than Wi-Fi through my house and other Wi-Fi connections. So to me, it really is, if you want to make this a community-based, a strong system that works across the country, you definitely need money. And there's no way around it. You can tell everybody that it's a great idea, it's a great idea, it's a great idea, but without the backing, without the support from not only the government, but the carriers, you're wasting your time. I mean, as far as I can tell, like I said, it really, to me, the most important thing we can do as a community that's encouraging internet for everyone is to go to these people and say, look, this needs to be done. Here's why, here's how much it costs, and here's what you get out of it. And if you help them understand that there is a benefit to them, and that's always been the problem. CAP was the same problem. They didn't see a benefit to it. All they saw was an expense. So we tried to, Peter and I actually went to Ottawa and talked to these people. At the time, it was the Conservative Party, I believe, or the Liberals were. Anyway, the point is they really didn't see a benefit to it. So it became a frustration level that was unsustainable. And that was my issue, why I dropped out of the Toronto Housing Project, was it was frustrating. It was just damn frustrating. I went to Toronto Housing and I said, we're working on a certain bandwidth. We can get more. All we have to do is ask for it. It doesn't cost any more money. And they went, no. And I mean, I couldn't understand it, but they said no. So they're like, okay, well, where do we go from here? So after 10 years of frustration working with the CAP program that actually got taken away, it was like, well, where do we go from here? And there was nowhere to go because there was no commitment from either the government or the carriers to take it forward. So I know maybe that's a lot to talk about or address at one time, but yeah, that's my story. I'm sticking to it. Thanks.
Thanks, Daryl. It's too bad we don't have Tracy Axelson here, because she has been running some major ISED projects, helping homeless people with wireless connections. And I think she's doing it across Western Canada, through the Vancouver network, Vancouver VCN, Vancouver Community Network. So there's that thing that's happening. I mean, it's interesting. I have been going through my old files. Who now it's COVID, so we've got to go through our old files, right? There might be stuff here we shouldn't keep. And I've been reading a lot of stuff that I've had since 1994, 95, which talked about the early days of the internet. Which talked about how we felt there and what we thought could be things for the public that should be retained and maintained. And now, looking at it all these many years later, I'm asking myself, what's left of that movement that came out at the beginning? People fought for trying to keep something that still resembled the public interest on the internet. And here we are. I mean, it's not completely gone. There's a whole lot of people. There's a bunch of people on this call, you know, who still represent exactly what people were looking for and asking for. Thing is, it's very under the radar, right? It doesn't show up or come up easily when you look for that. And we're small and we don't have a lot of resources. Any of us. And part of our problems is that we don't connect so easily. I see right now with Zoom, we finally got what telecommunities has been wishing for many years, is a way to connect that we can do, because we don't have any money, to talk to each other. Peter was providing the telephone line occasionally, but just so we could have an annual meeting. But now we can do this, and other groups can do this. So maybe there are ways coming up that we can, you know, we can get stronger, basically. I think that's my hope.
Sounds good to me.
Anybody else want to pipe up here? Fred, Ivan, Adrian, Shannon?
Can I ask a question?
Who's that?
This is Ivan. I'm not lighting up yellow for some reason. I've never done that on the Zoom call, and also Zoom broke my camera. Well, the software that runs my camera.
Please go ahead.
if I turn my video on, you'll just see a picture of the program that my camera uses to show me.
Okay, go ahead, Ivan. Please, we can hear you.
So how dependent are applications on having language and culture ingrained in them, basically? Here, our last fluent Mi'kmaq speaker died in 1978. Ongoing simulation factors, economic, societal, whatever you want to say. Like, I don't speak Mi'kmaq. And Flap'e, although it is a subset of a greater recognized First Nation known as Halibut, the community itself is the only other 100% Mi'kmaq community in Newfoundland outside of Con River, Miabogek. So it remains unrecognized. The community runs on projects, and basically when I worked there for 4 years, my job was tourism and economic development, and my budget, I was told when I sat down the first day, was my paycheck until I could find other money to do stuff. So that's the reality of where we are in Flap'e. So how much language and culture, and also are there parts, can you apply to, so I can help teach people in Flap'e to do this stuff? Like, is that all pieces that you can put in an application?
Is that question to Rob?
I think he's trying to unmute.
Yeah, was that for me?
Let's assume so.
Yeah. Okay. So if I understand it right, Ivan, so it's a question around like funding support for culture and language.
Right, and it's resources. A capacity question too, I guess. Like, we don't have, beyond the fact that Flap'e still exists, that is what we retain as our culture, the fact that the community is still there and is still full of Mi'kmaq people. But there's no presentational culture. Everything, like working in the woods, was the last thing. Having a connection to the forest, either the forestry industry or hunting and guiding, those were like the last remnants, and I don't do that anymore. So how much of that, it is like a offer, if there was a matrix that looked at these applications, what does the point system look like for that kind of stuff, and can you insert things that would actually allow the community to wean itself off of programs like this in the application?
Okay. I'm not sure if others have things to say as well, but one thing I wonder, Ivan, that may be useful is like, okay, so you think about something like digital literacy, right? And oftentimes it gets positioned against what you're describing. Like, there's like this assumed traditional practices and then this assumed, you know, futuristic digital. And I don't think that has to be the case. And so you could think about something like a grant or a program to teach digital literacy to people in your community. But what it really is kind of like an opportunity to go and do these kinds of things that you're talking about and like film it and then learn how to, you know, edit that or make a digital story or put it on, you know, share that information over a digital network. And so you can kind of frame it that it's about building technological skills, but it's also parallel to that is by doing the kinds of things you're talking about. I don't know if that's helpful or not, but I guess what I'm saying is I don't think they have to be separated. I think there's lots of ways to think of how technologies can support that kind of work and how programs that are designed for technological stuff can also support the kinds of things you're talking about.
But I'll jump in a little bit, Ivan, because I think the communities that I work with in northwestern Ontario, they're very small and very remote. And the language and culture was critical and to everyone who lived there. And therefore, like building the network, the community network, was one of the steps that was necessary to protect that language and culture, and that and framing it as like, you know, for yourself in your work as in building the network, like, I think keeping the language and culture front and center is critical, and so that the community itself can begin to adopt some of the things, skill sets that Rob just discussed and described. And so there's lots of opportunities like, you know, and a lot of, like, it's knowing which programs to go to, knowing which, like, you know, who's your allies, like, who's going to support the programs and understand what you're talking about, which is very difficult. That's where I talked about, that's where we were talking about the systemic racism that exists in many of the programs. Like, you know, what we end up talking about is multi-million dollar programs and projects, where what you're talking about is a community network that can build and develop that whole language and culture and, like, you know, and the resources to support it, supports the children in the schools and like all aspects in terms of the community. So I'd really encourage you to identify those champions, those program people who can assist you in what you're describing in terms of developing those kinds of resources and support systems that Rob talked about. But, like, you know, and Rob's done this in a couple of communities that I know of, in First Nation communities, like what he was just describing. So, like, it's all related to the language and culture in all aspects of it, because it goes right back to who that community is, like, you know, and defining that community and celebrating, like, you know, that unique existence that you just described. Does that help, Ivan? Did we lose him?
Here. Oh, look, I'm finally loading up red, yellow.
Yeah, Ivan, Brian was just asking whether or not that was helpful.
Yes, it was.
And I'd want to say that, you know, I'm sure that you can feel free to connect with anybody here. And if you'd like to be part of our group, part of our, and that's Shannon as well, put you on our mailing list, and we can continue to share our ideas and moving forward. I want to thank Rob for taking the time and sharing some of his knowledge and his skills with us. I think there's a whole lot more that he has to say that we haven't heard yet. So I think this is hopefully the beginning of a conversation.